come to our attention that a mysterious force is loose somewhere in outer space.
Welcome to Talk Tank.
Hello, you have reached the Talk Tank, the official LSE Entrepreneurs podcast where we delve into the minds of those who think, live, and breathe outside the box. My name is Jessica G and I will be your host for today. Welcome to Bits and Bytes, our series dedicated to innovation and technology at the heart of society's change. By searching into the technology that drives transformation, we will meet the humans who revolutionize our lives bit by bit. Today's episode is all about purpose. Mike Quinn is the co-founder and CEO of Boost, with a mission to power growth for the 100 million underserved entrepreneurs in Africa's informal economy who are creating sustainable jobs and income for the future. Prior to Boost, Mike was the co-founder and CEO of Zona, one of Africa's earliest fintechs. During his 10-year tenure, Zona processed $2.5 billion of transactions, generated $26 million in income for 3,000 micro-entrepreneurs, and raised $35 million in investment. Also a master's alumni from LSE, Mike has written the highly rated book, Failing to Win, Hard-Earned Lessons from a Purpose-Driven Startup. With startup insights from all over Africa, tune in to today's purpose-driven episode. Sponsored by the OVH Cloud Startup Program.
Hi, Jessica. Thank you for having me. I'm very excited for the conversation.
Yes, same here. So at this point, I've already introduced you briefly to our audience, but why don't you go ahead and put in your own words, who is Mike Quinn and what do you do?
Yes, big question to start. it took me writing a whole book to really dive into that and try to actually figure out the answer to that. But I am a Canadian. I grew up in a city called Calgary in Western Canada. Did mechanical engineering degree in the late 90s and early 2000s. And when I finished, I was actually towards the last 2 years, I should say, of my degree, mm-hmm. I was really trying to figure out what I wanted to, you know, be when I grew up and answer the question that everybody does at that stage in life, and try to find purpose in my life. And I didn't really want to just go get a regular job.
Yeah.
And ended up applying for a volunteer placement with this startup organization at the time called Engineers Without Borders. Mm-hmm. And that was a huge turning point in my life, where they sent me to Ghana in West Africa, mm-hmm. As a volunteer working on a rural agriculture project. At that point, I had no connection to Africa. I remember I had to look up Ghana on a map to figure out where it was. Mm. So it was just this like unknown place. I had never traveled before, so I was wow. just really excited to get out of Canada. I guess I'd just done family trips and but never like really done anything like this and been to Africa before. And ended up spending 2.5 years with Engineers Without Borders in Ghana first and then in Zambia for a second placement, because I had such a life-changing experience the first time that I realized like I wanted to start thinking about this as a career. Mm. I was thinking about development work as a career. And just like saw so many problems, but also so much opportunity in Africa. And I felt like I could apply my privilege and my skills and experiences I had gained like through this engineering degree to try to do some good in the world. But at the end of that placement, the end of my second placement, I should say, in Zambia, I realized that I was probably a bit too idealistic and naive. And, you know, I wasn't going to be able to change the world on my own just in a very short period of time. And I had more questions than answers. And so that led me to apply for this master's in development management degree at the London School of Economics. And then had a very lucky turning point there. In addition to like just having this amazing year at the LSE, I got into the MBA program at the University of Oxford at the Said Business yeah. School on a scholarship for social entrepreneurship. And it was while I was at Oxford that I started coming up with this idea around connecting purpose-driven entrepreneurs in Africa who were building scalable businesses but didn't have access to investment, and connecting them with investment funds and family offices and impact investors mm-hmm. in the global centers like London or New York or Washington. And I called this idea African Enterprise Partners, but mm-hmm. really it was just me with a business card and a logo, and started banging on doors of to investors I was meeting, and managed to get a consulting contract with this one fund called the Grassroots Business Fund that bought me a plane ticket back to Zambia once I had finished my MBA to go find entrepreneurs for them to invest in. And I ended up going back to Zambia, getting connected coincidentally to these two brothers that were just at the early stages of building what became one of the first fintechs on the continent, and ended up working with them for the next 10 years and then writing a book about it. So I'll pause there, but it was kind of a long and winding road to get to the start of this incredible journey I had with Zona.
Yeah, definitely a wild ride, not simple at all, but I mean, it sounds like it was really fun, full of adventure. I couldn't imagine going to a completely different continent, just breaking out of like tradition. You did an engineering degree, so most people would probably expect you, like your family, to become an engineer or do something in tech in your own country after, but going to Africa, it sounds actually really fun and crazy. So, you said that these trips to Africa with Engineers Without Borders were really big turning points in your life. What happened on these like exchanges and trips specifically? Is there anything you can tell us in that sense?
Yeah. So we were pushed really hard to integrate very deeply into like the local communities we worked in. Mm-hmm. As I can maybe explain as an example, my first experience of going to Ghana. I remember that we had a full-on living allowance or a stipend of just a few hundred dollars a month that was like all food, local accommodation. And we were given a plane ticket and a partner organization to work with, but we kind of had to figure out everything on our own because EWB was a startup organization at the time as well. So it was run mainly like the co-founders were recent graduates of engineering. And so it wasn't like a very formal organization or something that had been around for a decade. When I landed in Ghana, you know, I was picked up at the airport by another colleague, another volunteer who was there before me. Mm-hmm. He had found a one-bedroom room in like for me to stay in a slum in Accra. That had a fan and a bed and a mosquito net and a really small desk. And that was really it. Then I ended up moving from there to live with a Ghanaian family. I was learning some of the local language, and I had a project working in a very rural community that didn't have any electricity, setting up a small business with a little diesel engine mm-hmm. that could power agricultural processing equipment to save women in the community a lot of time, because they would normally have to like use manual labor to process all of their crops into like, you know, process maize into flour, or cassava was the other crop, into a cassava flour. But now this little diesel engine could be hooked up to this these two machines that could then process that all on an automated way and just save them a ton of time. It was very grassroots development work, but it was just like I learned so much about myself. I learned about poverty for the first time. I made connections with people who were just very different from me. So it was an amazing experience. I could probably talk about it for hours, but I'll pause there.
No, that sounds amazing. One thing I'm really curious to know, though, is when you get there, like obviously you're in this community, you're an outsider, a foreigner, and people notice that. So how did you immerse yourself into that culture? Because like there are so many international students at LSE, I'm sure you know, like 70% of the population, and already a lot of people have trouble already just like immersing themselves into like London, British culture, but like going to Africa, it's completely foreign. I can't even begin to like imagine. So how was that process like fitting in into the community?
Yeah, it's a good analogy even like coming to London, because I think you're right that everywhere, you know, there's microcultures like in every city or every country that you live in. The thing that I guess was really different about, you know, when I went to Ghana and Zambia is just like being a minority, like because the color of my skin made me stand out. Right? Being a white person, I was in Ghana. They call white people Obrunis, and you know, I'd go for a run, and I'd have like a group of kids like following me, shouting Obruni, and like running with me, and just like not having any, you know, privacy or always standing out, and also just trying to experience for the first time in my life what it was like to be different and not like the majority. a very eye-opening experience for me, and I think it built a lot of empathy. I have to give like EWB a lot of credit in preparing us, because they made it, like they pushed us, and we had a couple weeks of pre-departure training before going, and it was like the culture of the organization and of my peers that were also going on these other volunteer placements, mm-hmm. where we really were looking for experiences that challenged us, and we were pushed hard by the organization to like immerse ourselves, mm-hmm. Because it was based on this this like almost founding principle that, you know, we couldn't have any impact overseas unless we really empathized and tried our best to understand the local context and yes. build like very deep relationships with the people we are working with. And so there was a purpose to it. And through that, you know, what I learned is that I ended up probably benefiting way more than I gained, because what I learned from the communities I lived in and the people I worked with and just like experiencing a different culture created, like it changed me. And probably created a lot of like new values and some of the principles that I've lived my life by ever since. So the work I did and like the impact I had was minuscule compared to the benefit I got out of it, but was really just like having that mindset going in and then constantly pushing myself to like understand and learn and connect with people who were very, very different from me in a yes. setting that was like far outside of my comfort zone. And I'm so happy I did it.
I mean, that's amazing. Even small things like hearing how like you realized your own privilege then and stuff, that's very like refreshing to hear, because I'm going to be honest, like a lot of white people don't really say stuff like that when they go to, especially when they travel to different countries. But now that I want to talk about Zuna, so you said in your book that you actually convinced your parents to mortgage their house while they were retiring to get you $100,000 to invest in the Zuna business when it was starting out. Like, how do you even begin like a leap of faith like that? How did you convince your parents, and why did you have so much faith in Zuna?
Yeah, so great questions. So the starting point was, as I mentioned, when I was at Oxford, yeah. I kept meeting all of these investors and impact investors that wanted to like invest in Africa, but we're talking about this problem of not having deal flow, which is like investor jargon for, you know, not being able to find entrepreneurs or investment ready businesses that mm-hmm. they could deploy capital to, and because they weren't on the ground. And I knew that, you know, there's lots of entrepreneurs in Africa building amazing businesses, but also they didn't have connections or access to the capital in global markets that could actually fuel the growth of those businesses. And and so that was the starting idea. When I pitched this investment fund, they bought me a plane ticket to Lusaka, the capital of Zambia. And I sent an email to a few people and got connected to Brad and Brett, these two brothers starting Zuna, which is pronounced Zona, which
sorry.
Means it's real in the local language. Zona. No, no problem. Everybody does. Everybody says it because it's like Z-O-O-N-A. But at the time, actually, the pre-Zona name was called Mobile Transactions. It was like a very kind of corporate.
That's a very different name, yeah.
Yeah, it got rebranded later. They were starting this business, and this was pre-smartphone. The market in Zambia at the time had about 13 million people. 90% of adults were unbanked. Mm. It was a complete cash economy. And so these very simple things that we take for granted around sending and receiving money to one another, like, you know, if I need to pay for mm-mm. a bill or send you money or send like a relative money for something, or it could be like a health emergency or paying your kids' school fees. If nobody has bank accounts, it's like really difficult to do that. And everybody was just physically moving cash around. Very expensive, very risky. And so these two guys had this idea around like building a money transfer platform that people could do like instant digital money transfers from anywhere in the country, like from a sender to a receiver. And I was just captivated by this. I knew nothing about technology, but when I met them, you know, they already had this vision of a cashless economy. And they were starting with like payments in the agricultural payments from a cotton company to do digital payments to smallholder farmers. And, you know, this was back in like 2007 to 2009 before I even met them. And I met them in 2009. And when they were telling me about this vision, and I then convinced this investment fund to do like a $200,000 seed investment in them, because you know, the impact potential was huge. The upside potential from an investment point of view was huge. And but I knew very early on that like I wasn't cut out to be an investor, even though I was consulting for an investment fund. The fund like immediately was like, you know, Mike, go find us another deal. Like we could build a portfolio. But I was already at that point, like I had a desk in their office. I was telling Brad and Brett, the you know, founding brothers, that I wanted to go all in with them and work with them. And I ended up doing a deal where the investment fund provided me with a small stipend to, you know, to live off of. And then Brad and Brett provided me with sweat equity in the business. And several months later, you know, I realized like I just needed to be a partner in this company. Like this was a family business to start with. But I had no money and I had a huge student loan from LSE that I had to pay off. And my wife, who I convinced to move to Zambia with me, we actually met at LSE, was really supporting us and covering all of our bills. And I, you know, went to my parents, and they were retired high school teachers. So they were not rich. They never made a risky investment in their life. Like my parents are actually quite conservative from a financial point of view, but, my mom said I just made I gave her a really hard sell job about how we were going to change the world and we were going to like provide digital financial services to help all of these people in Africa and create like this digital economy. And I you know, said to her, I'm like, you know, if I'm not asking for a down payment on a house, I'm actually instead I'm you know looking for funds that I can invest in this company that's going to have this huge impact. And her and my dad went to the bank and took a mortgage out on their retirement home and lent me $100,000. And it was just like an amazing leap of faith.
But
also reinforces, you know, you mentioned the word privilege. Like I had parents that I could go to that were able and willing to do that. And I just felt like extremely lucky. But that's what made me a founding partner in the business. And Brad would always say, you know, when you have bacon and eggs for breakfast, the chicken is involved, but the pig is committed. And he would say that was the moment where I became pig. I became the zone of pig.
Oh my God.
So they started seeing me as like the third brother from that point on.
So now that you've kind of moved away from Zona, you've co-founded like the supply platform in Africa called Boost. I just want to know, like, and especially our audience wants to know, so what does Boost do and why is it important? Like, why does Africa need it?
Yeah, so Boost exists to power growth for, as you mentioned, the 100 million entrepreneurs in Africa's informal economy. And like the informal economy is the economy in Africa. It employs... the latest statistic I saw was 76% of jobs in urban centers in Africa. And the, you know, the population in Africa is very young. The average age is about 19. So more and more people, you know, that are entering their 20s looking for jobs. There's not enough corporate jobs or government jobs to employ them all. So they become self-employed and they work in, you know, provision stores or, you know, fruit and vegetable stands or restaurants or distribution or they, you know, become wholesalers. So this is the economy that, that I know, you know, very well. And, it's still primarily, underserved, offline trades and cash. But what's now different is everybody has, mobile phones and, compared to when we started Zona, everybody has smartphones, or I shouldn't say everybody, cause there's still a gap, but like, smartphone penetration is getting, you know, smartphones are becoming more and more accessible. And what Boost is doing is building a digital ordering platform for retail entrepreneurs in the informal economy that are running like FMCG provision grocery stores or fruit and vegetable stands or restaurants or pharmacies to order stock and to access financial services. Because a lot of the times these small businesses, the owners have to spend a huge amount of time going to the market or visiting different wholesalers just to discover prices, buying goods from lots of different people, organizing transport back to their shops. They don't have bank loans or access to financial services to get to aggregate enough demand to like buy in bulk and get good pricing. So we're trying to solve that that challenge. But critically important, it's connected to the Zona story, is how at Zona, we scaled up in Zambia and Malawi, but we were never really successful at building like the Pan-African platform. Yeah. That was our vision. Mm-hmm. And we raised, you know, at Zona $35 million, and we tried to go into Mozambique and we failed, and we tried to go into DRC and didn't really get started. Mm-hmm. And so with Boost, what I wanted to do this time was to build a Pan-African platform business from the beginning. Mm. By design. And so I'm now based in London. I've got two co-founders in London that one builds the technology, one builds our systems and operations. Mm-hmm. And her name's Mary. She was also an Engineers Without Borders volunteer from Canada. So I connected with her from many years ago. Mm-hmm. And we've set up co-founding teams in Ghana, Nigeria, South Africa, and Egypt, completely remotely, because mm-hmm. we weren't expecting to do this during COVID. That just kind of happened. We're able to learn like a lot of the lessons around business building and capital raising and building teams and culture and product and figuring out like how to build a business model that could scale across multiple markets, and design Boost to be able to do this. Our platform is now like in four countries, and it solves this pain point of small retail entrepreneurs ordering stock, accessing working capital, and having goods delivered to them. And mm-hmm. the complexity is really like how we do that. So we enable suppliers to bring their catalogs and their brands onto our platform, informal distributors who do the last mile delivery, local teams that are doing like customer acquisition. So there's a lot of stuff that happens on the ground, but I never would have been able to even kind of conceive of this opportunity or this business model if I didn't like have 10 years working in the trenches, building Zona up from the very beginning to like the scale it eventually reached.
Yeah, definitely. Something really interesting you said, though, is you guys founded and started scaling up Boost during COVID, and you're doing this remotely. So your whole team is working in London, I think you said. So how do you even, like, I can't imagine creating a business in a foreign continent while you're working somewhere else. Like, how does that work?
Yeah. So the principle is like that. Mm-hmm. a few things. Let me start over on that. So one of the things that I really learned at Zona, once we started scaling and we had money in the bank, was that I spent most of my time as the CEO building the company and very little of my time with our customers. And that was like, it became a huge challenge. And you know, I would spend all my time like dealing with investors or fundraising or hiring people or dealing with culture issues. And then when I left Zona, and I took a sabbatical, and I was like writing the book, and I was mentoring other startups, I was realizing how much time all of these like startup CEOs and founding teams were spending as well, like chasing money and building the business, and these things that like can be standardized. And so the idea with Boost was to centralize all of the business building functions around capital raising, technology, brand, back office operations into a very lean centralized function, which is what we do in the UK. Mm-hmm. I have two co-founders in the UK. We work remotely. We're virtual, so it's not like a big team. Mm. And then on the ground in each market, we then have co-founders and teams, who then build teams locally that are responsible for all the things that need to be done locally. So customer acquisition, local partnerships, local distribution, fulfillment. And they don't have to spend all of their time fundraising, because I take care of that. Yeah. They don't have to have their own local engineering teams, because Will, in my UK co-founder, builds the technology platform. Mary builds the back office and the systems. Mm-hmm. And then they can use all of this like platform infrastructure to scale faster. And then we trust them to, to all of our co-founders in each market to like adapt the model, because I've learned how to hire people, how to manage remotely, and I've become much more self-aware of the things that like I will never be good at. Like I will never know the Nigerian market as well as like my near Nigerian co-founders or my Ghanaian co-founders or South African ones, and so it's really. A lot of it is just like learning how to let go and being conscious of like where you add the most value and where you don't add the most value. And then like finding the right people who fit who are aligned with the purpose and values of what Boost is trying to achieve, can work in this remote environment and are very skilled and experienced at doing the things that they need to do in their markets. And then, I can work remotely because I'm playing the role of an enabler as opposed to being like an on the ground operator.
Yeah.
But it's a very necessary role because every one of these companies that we're building like needs money, right? Yeah. And they need all of these centralized assets that we're building in the UK. But it's quite an innovative model to do it from the beginning. Most startups will go deep in their market and then they'll raise a whole bunch of money and then they'll start scaling on the back of that. And so we're doing it the opposite way, where we've like planted seeds in multiple countries from the very beginning, mm-hmm. And then are building the systems to scale. And I'm seeing the results of doing it that way. I think we're getting a larger addressable market, more traction for less effort and less resources. And I'm very excited to scale on the back of that.
Yeah, no. Well, you recognize your strengths and you're playing to them, even if it doesn't mean you're directly in the countries and I don't know. Yeah, as you said, raising things from the ground up. But one thing I did notice while you were working at Zona is you actually, 8 years into working there, you did this whole like customer immersion trip and you actually filmed like a little YouTube docuseries on it. You're going around meeting people from different like areas and towns and villages, really, really integrating yourself into the culture, into the customers, which is quite rare for like a CEO to do, especially when you've been working in like, it's a pretty big company at that point. It's like been established for 8 years. So I just want to know, like, what did you gain from this whole like immersion trip, and would you recommend other CEOs to do it? I know you wrote some articles about that.
Yeah. So if I put myself back into my shoes like that time, we had recently raised a $15 million Series B investment round. We had hired a huge team, so we were now over 200 people. We had expanded and failed actually expanding into Mozambique and burnt a lot of cash in the process, multiple millions of dollars trying to expand without much success. And then I had exited my first non-founder executive hire. And then we were just in the process of like turning over a bunch of our staff. So we'd scaled up our team and then like had to like raise money, scaled up our team, and then like it wasn't working. And I was completely burnt out. I was spending like all my time, like even as I mentioned before, like with investor management and people and culture issues. And I couldn't remember the last time I'd actually talked to a customer, and I didn't actually know why I was even working there anymore. Even though I was the CEO of the business. So
yeah.
I had this idea to do a customer immersion journey, really just to refine, reconnect and find my mojo again. Mm-hmm. It was like very selfish intentions because I didn't think I would last much longer if I didn't do it. And I kind of thought back to like, when was I the happiest? And back to my Engineers Without Borders roots of like integrating into the community. And I'm like, that's how we got Zona off the ground in the early days. I was always out in the field, always with like our agents and our customers and like understanding their problems and challenges. And we were iterating really quickly because I was in touch. And now there was like four levels of like, people between me and a customer. And so I took a month off and a month where I just cleared my calendar. And I just did a trip across Zambia and Malawi, visiting all of our top agents, who were like the main drivers of our business. They were our core customers. And I would work with them. I would stay with them. I would eat dinner with their families and get to know them on a personal level. And I found probably three big learnings. Like one, it was a huge source of energy for me. So I was able to get like my mojo back, and I was inspired and I remembered why I was doing this in the first place. Second is I actually learned what was really happening on the ground. And like, I wasn't hearing it from, filtered view. And like the deep insights came from, not from like asking, our customers what was how they were. It was actually from sitting around having conversations with them, like eating dinner with them, talking to their families, realizing how, like, hearing, I remember one of our agents in this town called Cabway, Paul, his wife telling me how he like works every single day except for Christmas, and he's always stressed, and he's always like carrying around cash all the time and worried about getting like robbed, and like just hearing things around like their family telling me what it was like to like be like the wife of one of our agents, for example, in this case. And then like the third big insight was then how much energy it gave to the rest of our staff, because I took this guy, Sevi, from our call center, who was a videographer in his spare time, and he was making videos of me like talking to customers and then sharing it with our staff. And then eventually it got kind of produced into a YouTube series, as you mentioned, for the public. But before that, like our staff were watching this, and they were then starting to like, you know, rapid prototype solutions to the problems I was sharing, that like from the interviews with our customers. And they were then sharing these videos with their family. And I was getting private messages from our staff saying like, you know, my wife or my husband now is like, you know, realizes why I work so hard at Zona and why I care so much about this company's mission. And so, it was just amazing, like amazing for my energy, amazing for my understanding of the business, and our customer's reality, amazing for like motivation, inspiration of our staff and like, and their families and support networks. And so I would recommend that of any CEO or founder, and to like systematize this into your routines. It's like, this kills me right now, like not being able to travel and do this. Like, this is the hardest part about kind of working in a COVID world. And I've accepted as well, like that a lot of my customers are now like the CEOs and the teams of the market we work in. So I try to like put myself in their shoes. But like to really define who your customers are and like get on the ground with them or put yourself in their shoes, and don't just like do surveys, like really like build empathy with them, right? Or like figure out how to like, you know, break bread with them and understand like the world through their lens. And then it's amazing like what can happen if you can do that.
No, definitely. I didn't think any employment survey or anything would cover what you found out about Paul and stuff through his wife. I mean, these are very crazy stories. Just from a simple little trip, all this insight that you gain in this, as you said, like empathy for these people who are your agents, who are your customers. Totally. And I think you mentioned before and on a previous call with me that, so you guys were getting series funding and you were trying to expand and go into Mozambique. I think you mentioned before that you guys put in like 6 million or just like quite a few million into this project, this expansion. And so obviously it didn't go completely well, but is there anything, like if you were to go back in time, would you have had a different approach, or would you have just not try to expand at all? Is there anything you would have changed? Stuff that you think, like you can tell us about the failures. Sorry, failing to start up is your book there, but tell us about your failures so that other people don't make the same mistake.
Yeah, and that's maybe a great way to also frame like this book I wrote, which is called Failing to Win.
Yeah,
and this, you know, spoiler alert. I left on my 10th year anniversary at Zona. In the midst of a cash, you know, crisis, where we were laying off most of our staff, the company was close to going bust. Luckily, didn't. I left, you know, feeling like, oh, we really failed to win, and I felt like a failure. And then, on the process of reflecting and writing about it, I realized like how the entire 10-year journey, we were consistently like failing. And then we would have like these moments where like they were like milestones, or we would, you know, break through and win at something. And so the big like lesson learned was like, we were always failing in order to win. Like, so we failed to, like, I failed to win in the end, but there was like the whole startup journey was this like string of failures that led to like building a pretty awesome company and achieving a huge amount of impact. You know, processing $2.5 billion of transactions for like 3 million customers, and creating a market and a, you know, that wasn't there before. So, the one that you mentioned, which was like a chapter I wrote calling failing to expand, we raised a $15 million Series B investment, to expand Pan-African and go from a very successful business in Zambia and Malawi to then launch like in all these different markets. And the one we went deepest in was Mozambique. And we did in hindsight was like the wrong expansion strategy where we hired, you know, too big a team. We didn't understand the market well enough. We approached it as like an expansion as opposed to like a new startup. And that was like a key lesson I learned, like where when you go into a new market to treat it as if you're like entering for the first time and you're like a new company where you're like, you go in like piloting and innovate, like iterating to find product market fit as opposed to a copy paste of your model. And we were like just way too cocky. And we didn't understand enough about Mozambique or the use cases. We were incentivized wrongly by one of our investors that linked a huge amount of our investment to a very rapid rollout of our model. And it just like, it didn't work. And I think I look back in that time and I'm like, you know, we could have had a different strategy. We could have done a lot of things differently, but the one thing I wish we did was just gone in with a small amount of money and a very lean team and just tried to approach it where we, you know, as I mentioned, where we were just like, we didn't know anything about the market and let's just go experiment until we find product market fit before we choose to really invest. I think if we had done that, we might have still failed, but we would have spent a lot less money and a lot less time doing that and realizing it. And then we would have had a lot more money left in our bank account to then fight the battles that we ended up having to fight in our core markets in Zambia and Malawi later down the line. But because we went in just like, you know, investing too much too quickly, it put ourselves in a very precarious position later.
Moving on to our final section, actually, though, called Real Talk. So I'm just going to ask you two questions. We ask all our guests these questions. It doesn't matter what industry they're from. They could be completely unrelated to what you're doing. But these are kind of some deep societal questions we want to get your thoughts on, get a grain of salt from you. So the first question I want to ask you, and you can take a second to think about if you want, is if you could change one thing about society, what would it be?
I think I would wish that we would all become better at listening to each other and really trying to understand one another, especially people that have different views and perspectives from your own.
I see.
So this is what I've really learned, like as a white male Canadian now, having worked in like various countries in Africa and now like living in the UK, I've benefited so much from just like being in these like immersive experiences with people who are very different from me, who have like very different backgrounds and live in different cultural contexts. And so much of the world, I think, is just because people are stuck, or problems in the world are because we're like existing within our own echo chambers and we don't have enough patience for one another. We're not really listening to each other to understand. And I'm guilty of this as I think all humans are. It's natural, but I think if we all spent a little bit more time trying to understand other perspectives and just connecting with one another who aren't like us, then I think the world would be a better place.
Couldn't agree more. Great sentiment. Next question: what's an unconventional truth you believe helped you achieve your success?
Another good one. I don't want to be cliche by quoting Robert Frost, but I do genuinely believe kind of my success has been very much rooted in taking the road less traveled. So, you know, going from an engineering degree, but then volunteering in Africa and then from volunteering in Africa to like entrepreneurship and like business. And then and even like my journey as an entrepreneur, not looking just for traditional business, like becoming a purpose-driven entrepreneur and trying to really connect purpose and profit and building like scalable business models that can like maximize societal impact. So I'm always trying to figure out like what is everybody else doing and then how do I do something that's different from that? And I've had a lot of success. So I think taking the road less traveled, like don't just listen to, you know, what everybody else is doing, whether it's your parents or your peers or your, you know, your professors at school, like try to find like, what are the things that
a great truth. So find
your own path,
like spiel about, you know, embracing failures and, you know, not getting into a state of mind where you just believe you are a failure and you get depressed and you can't, you're like, you lose motivation. I think that definitely connects to what you just said. And also it is a little bit unconventional, the truth you said about not listening to other people, walking your own path. I mean, I can personally say as an LSE student, like more than 50% of the student body population here, we're all stuck in like a box of people just want to go into investment banking and finance. So we all have like a very traditional one way of thinking. So hearing someone say, you know, walk your own path and it's okay not to conform or listen to what other people say, it's nice to hear. But thank you so much for your time, Mike, and for talking to us about your trek through the African startup ecosystem. But to wrap up our interview, we have one final question to ask you. So if you could invite anyone in the world you want for a podcast interview, if our seats were switched, who would you invite?
I would invite Trevor Noah.
That's a good one.
African comedian. Yeah, I just, and he embodies the listening to people from different cultures and just like living this life of connecting dots from, you know, people who are different from one another. Mm-hmm. I love his comedy, but he would be the person I would invite and I would love to have for dinner sometime.
Yes. He's a very funny person, a great character to have on. Good answer. All right. Thank you so much, Mike, for coming on. Thank you for your time.
Thank you, Jessica.
Thanks for tuning in. See you next week and leave your message after the beep.